Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Paul Taylor, the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event. Tonight, we'll be continuing our exploration with Dr. Mark Gaffney. Terry Patton is the visionary behind this groundbreaking series and our host. Terry is a leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality, who supports, challenges, guides, and connects evolutionaries all over the world. He is the author, with Ken Wilber, of Integral Life Practice, and his personal website is integralspiritualpractice.com. Warm welcome to you, Terry.
Thanks, Paul. Hi, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, a public exploration of the question of our time, the elephant in the living room. How can our hearts, our spirituality, help us to rise to the challenges of our time in a moment of crisis so that we can transition through so many key transitions that seem to be before us? And we've had a whole series of really adventuresome and wide-ranging, probing, enlivening conversations where we've focused on many specific aspects of this question. And tonight we're going to zero in on a particular angle with Dr. Mark Gaffney in a dialogue entitled Identifying Your Unique Gift. Dr. Mark Gaffney is a rabbi and a very original, iconoclastic teacher of Kabbalah and world spirituality. He's director of the Integral Life Spiritual Center, founder and core faculty member of iEvolve Global Practice Community. He's written 7 books, including the national bestseller, Soul Prince, and The Mystery of Love, an exploration of the relationship between the sexual, the erotic, and the sacred. In The Path of Personal Evolution, he teaches, he emphasizes both the agony and the ecstasy of what he calls sacred autobiography. He weaves this together with deep explication of the meanings of sacred texts. And he holds a doctorate from Oxford University, and his dissertation was written on non-dual humanism in Kabbalah. I first met Mark at the Integral Spiritual Center with Ken Wilber probably 4 or 5 years ago, and I gradually got to know him in the years since. And then earlier this year, he moved right into my neighborhood just north of San Francisco, and I've gotten to know him much better just in the last few months. And something I especially appreciate about Mark is how during times of great blessings as well as great losses, including the loss of sleep that came after the birth of his baby son, he's maintained an amazing level of physical, emotional, and mental energy, and he's continually kept choosing sweetness over bitterness, even under some circumstances a few years ago when he endured a lot of challenges. So I really came to love and respect the heart choices that I saw Mark making. And another thing I appreciate about Mark is a core insight that he has articulated clearly and he continually champions in the public conversations about integral spirituality, which is the importance of not conflating separateness with uniqueness. And you can be unique, therefore, without being separate. Very interesting and important distinction. It has potentially important implications for each of us, and I'm looking forward to exploring that more deeply with him tonight. So welcome, Mark. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you very, very much, and it's a delight and pleasure to be here. And just one small caveat, the Integral Life Spiritual Center has kind of evolved into the Center for World Spirituality, which is that's kind of our evolution. So it's been a nice evolution, you know, together with our dear mutual friend Ken Wilber and Sally Kempton, you know, et cetera, with Mariana Kaplan and our friend Di. And, you know, we look forward as the center evolves to working together with you, Terry, and with you know, in all the ways that we will, you know, in the Bay Area and around the world, and especially to drinking good chai at our local Fairfax Cafe.
Okay, very good.
So there you have it.
Well, you know, Mark, we've been unfolding a wide-ranging and really deep and I think in some ways adventuresome and kind of challenging conversation, because many people, as you know, are reading the news and turning green. You know, it is challenging to see what kind of new levels of complexity and speed of change and disruption of things. It's almost like tectonic shifts seem to be going on in our world. And we're clearly at a time in which human culture has a chance to make one of these big moves, like in the theory of evolutionary punctuated equilibrium. Things stay the same for a long time, and then they make a big move. It seems like, whoa, our hair's getting blown back by something major. And if this is not just bad news, not just a difficult and you know, and I don't think that in our spiritual hearts we feel that we can just interpret something like this in a negative way. We finding our positive relationship to it and finding our way to contribute seem like important spiritual questions. And even more than that, finding how our spiritual practice can enable us to rise to those challenges seems like a question that is important to so many of us. And here you've brought forth this very particular emphasis on uniqueness, on the unique self and one's unique gift. How might you bring that perspective to bear on this big question?
Well, thank you. That's a fantastic inquiry. And let's just, you know, see if we can unfold it together for a few minutes. So let's just think about it together, right? I mean, one, whenever there are, maybe I'll step back for a second here and just kind of state, just for those people who are not familiar with it, just what the basic teaching of unique self is, and then apply it to your question. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Sounds good.
Okay. So the basic teaching of unique self, and I'm delighted to actually have finished you know, we all know the delight of finishing a new book. So the original teaching of unique self I unfolded in a book called Soul Prints that Terry mentioned earlier, and in this doctoral work at Oxford, but the kind of public intellectual or public spiritual version of it just finished, and it's coming out with Sounds True with our dear friend Tammy Simon in the summer, and it's called Unique Self, the Future of Enlightenment. So let me kind of talk about it in that context as an Enlightenment teaching. So first, when we talk about an Enlightenment teaching, as we wrote so beautifully in that blurb that you send out, I want to introduce the idea of the democratization of enlightenment, kind of make that kind of the first point. That is to say that while enlightenment as a genuine option used to be limited to, you know, folks, you know, in the back streets of Jerusalem and in the, you know, distant hills of the Himalayas and in Nepal, today enlightenment is a genuine possibility. Now, of course, there are gradations of enlightenment. We're not engaging in a kind of green level consciousness leveling of differences. We recognize natural hierarchy. That all I'm taking as a given, you know, with the folks that are in this kind of conversation, but I think it's important to state. So when I say enlightenment, I don't mean that everyone's Ramana Maharshi, right? But I mean that actually that you're living from a stable ground, right, of enlightened consciousness, meaning you're not living from a contracted, coiled, small self sense. You have a sense of your own natural small self identity, but you're not identified with it. And so we're not talking about evolution beyond ego, but we're talking about evolution beyond the exclusive identification with ego. So that Terry Patton is Terry Patton's small self, right, hanging out in the Fairfax Cafe, right, but he's also Terry Patton who experiences himself as part of the default of his experience, right, as part of the larger seamless code of the universe, which is what the core of enlightenment is. And I'm living, I'm breathing, I'm laughing and crying from that place. And even when there's a stimulus response in a negative sense, there's a stimulus that's painful, and my response is angry, or my response is hurt, or my response is petty, I don't become that response, but I actually witness that response, and I experience my partness as being not a part, but part of the larger whole. So that's the general context. Now, unique self then steps into that deep, you know, mind-blowing teaching. It literally blows your mind. I mean, it blows your limited mind, and you realize your participation in big mind, big heart, right, in expanded consciousness, like the Kabbalists say, right? And the unique self teaching then enters that and says, when that happens, when your identity shifts from separate self to true self, when you realize that the total number of true selves is one. You're part of the great true self. You then realize you're part of the seamless code of the universe. You realize that code is seamless, but it's not featureless. That actually, right, the seam, right, that is you, that's part of the larger whole, also remains a part, a unique part, a distinct part. You've moved beyond your sense of separate self. You've exploded the delusion of separate self. You're now part of the larger whole, right? You're part of the larger seamless code of the universe, but in a particular, unique, and distinct way. Right? What emerges out of your deep realization of true self is you say, ah, my true self, and my true self is unique. So I'm not separate, right, but I am unique. Terry and Mark are not separate from the larger one. Right? We live from a place, right, in which that's our default experience. I'm part of the larger one, and yet we're distinct. We're unique expressions of the larger one. And so in some sense, one might say that when Terry's living, breathing in the world and doing the Beyond Awakening series, right, and he's at his fullest self, God is having a Terry experience, right? Oh, my God, right? God's having a Terry experience. And if God's having a Terry experience and then finds Mark there, you know, or Diane or Craig, our friend, or Mariana, you know, or Claire or whoever it is, God says, damn, this is painful. I'm trying to have a Terry experience, right? I'm nourished by Terry holding that unique perspective that's held only by Terry, and I, all that is, the divine I, the I am, right? The I am, the Buddha mind, right? The all that is, the seamless code of the universe, in evolutionary terms, right? The throbbing love intelligence of the cosmos, which is all that is, right? Can see a particular dimension of reality only through Terry's unique perspective. And so the divine, all that is, right, wants to have a Terry experience. And if Mark's there, because Terry's imitating Mark, or Mark's imitating Terry, or John's imitating, you know, Timothy, right, then the divine, in Kabbalistic terms, is an exile, right, because the divine can't see through that unique set of eyes. So in that sense, from a unique self perspective, to love God, you know, in bracket, the God you don't believe in doesn't exist, right, end bracket, to love God, all that is, right, the evolutionary impulse of love intelligence that throbs in the cosmos with a personal face, right? So to love God is to let God see through your eyes, is to clarify the doors of perception that allow you to be seeing uniquely, to hold that perspective that's available uniquely to you, and then to make that perspective available to the divine, to make that perspective available to God. And so actually the only genuine individuality that exists from an enlightened perspective is the matured individuality is in the context of union. And in the context of union, I emerge as a unique individual holding a unique perspective which gives birth to unique gifts. And not only unique gifts, but unique obligation, a unique ability to respond, right, in a way that no one else can quite respond. Right, that when I actually begin to realize that the divine, that all that is, that the love intelligence of all that is loves me so much that he, she, it signed his, her name all over me, that the divine lives in me, as me, and through me uniquely, right, living and seeing and breathing through my unique eyes, right, that I'm God's verb. I'm not just an adjective. I'm God's verb. Right? I'm God's dangling modifier. Right, and as I, you know, God's hands are my hands, right? I live, right, my letter in the cosmic scroll, which is that unique expression of myself. So that's the basic teaching of unique self, which says that the enlightened function isn't an awakened impersonal function, right? Only clearly you need to awaken to the impersonal beyond the personality, right? So there's the personality level one. Level two, I awaken beyond the personality to true self, which is sometimes called the impersonal, right? What a deep and beautiful enlightenment teaching that we actually feel in reality. But then that true self, that impersonal function, reveals itself uniquely, right, as unique self. And so that changes the entire enlightenment teaching, right, and it helps people actually understand, which brings us back directly to your inquiry, Terry. It helps people understand their specialness. Not their specialness in the sense of, right, I'm special, you're not, right? I'm special. I'm special. Terry, hey, like you're a nice guy, Terry, but you're not. I mean, I'm special. Let's get real, right? And that's that kind of egoic specialness that is being trapped in the pettiness of ego in which specialness is comparative. But actually, the special at the level of unique self, right, is a level of specialness in which I realize that I'm a unique expression of all that is, that never was, is, or will be, and that's a unique invitation that I can respond to that gives me the joy of my life, which is to fulfill my unique obligation to give love uniquely in a way that no one else can, to wipe tears that I can wipe away that no one else can, right, to be God's verb and dangling modifier, to do something for all that is that no one else can do but me. And I have this experience, as Ibn Gabay said it in the 16th century, he said, Avodat Tzorach Gavoa, if I can use the original language, right, God needs your service. There's something, right, that I can do that no matter what you do, Terry, you're never going to be able to do. And there's something that you can do, Terry, that no matter what I do, I'm just not going to be, I won't do it. And that opens up the place for me to rejoice in your gifts and to create this feel of like, wow, oh my God, I'm with Terry. I can kneel and kiss the ground because I'm rejoicing at my perception of your infinite, gorgeous uniqueness. And then I become a lover, because to become a lover is to see with God's eyes, which is to see the infinite, unique self of other. Love is a unique self perception. So that's the core, you know, if I can, you know, with, you know, permission of all the holy beings and masters, you know, to try and say this big teaching in you know, 13 minutes is almost sacrilege, but at least I hope we get a taste of it, right, as the teachers say. So now to bring it home to Terry, to your inquiry. So for the first time in history, in your inquiry, if I can just maybe restate it for my own sake, you know, I'm getting old, so I got to kind of hold some clarity here, right? How does this teaching play in this world which is so rapid, so fast changing, so wired? So, you know, how does unique self offer us a way of navigating this new and complex post-postmodern reality that we're all finding ourselves in? And here, I think it's such an exciting question, and I hope the response is equally compelling. It excites me, which is something like this. It used to be that the only individual who really had an impact was the king. And when I say the king, I mean it as an archetype, meaning those uniquely gifted, aristocratic, royal blood people, you know, very, very narrow sector of humanity that had any real impact, that had any real voice. I mean, everyone else, you know, drudged in anonymous desperation, right? Living lives that, you know, were born, suffered, and died, and in just an incredible, you know, tragic context which existed virtually all over the world. And for the first time in the last, you know, since the Enlightenment, you know, the Western Enlightenment, the Industrial Revolution, but it's speeded up in the last 30 years with the information technology, this new kind of wave of consciousness, post-Industrial Revolution, which is the information age, in which we're all kind of beginning to be wired and connected to each other, in which more individuals have websites today than, you know that 20 million, 30 million people with their own individual websites were in this utterly, utterly new reality, which in the individual, right, has enormous, enormous impact. The individual has enormous, enormous impact, right? The individual can actually get across their ideas. The individual can express a point of view. The individual can download into mass culture, right, an entire set of understandings, an entire set of perceptions, right? The individual can transmit impact in incredible ways that were literally never true in the history of humanity, right? The democratization of power is beginning to happen. And, of course, we understand it always from the destructive side, right? Will a rogue terrorist, you know, with an atom bomb, you know, create a nuclear explosion? That's the destructive side. But let's look at the constructive side. Will a rogue, creative, beautiful heart mind, right, set off a chain of giving and love and delight and imagination and generosity that will catch on, right, and light up the globe, right? The invitation, you know, for the individual, right, to actually transform, right, reality, right, lives in a way that's never, ever lived, right, in the history of consciousness, of humanity, right, of anything that we know. The individual stands poised, right, to make a contribution in a way that was never true. And in order to do that, right, what one needs to do is to identify, what do I have to say? Right, what's my unique voice? Right, what's my unique gift, right, that I have? Right, what's the teaching, right, the living, the being and the becoming that I have that exists no place in the world, right, other than in me. Right? That's unbelievably exciting. Right? To identify, right, my unique gift, right, my unique, wonderful, awesome saying to the world, right, that I can actually write into consciousness, into the source code of consciousness, right, by actually giving it through the many means that are available today. That's an unbelievably exciting way to live. Depression is replaceability. Depression is the sense that if I'm not here, someone else is going to do it. And that if I do have something unique to say, there's no way to transmit it. For the first time today, if I can identify my unique gift, and we can talk about later how I do that and what might be the ways to identify, what are the five uniquenesses. But if I can identify my unique gift, right, from that uniqueness wells all of my power. Because all my power, my personal power, wells from that unique expression of divinity that lives in me, as me, and through me, which lives in no one else but me. That's unbelievably, I mean, there's nothing more powerful, right, that will allow a person, right, to get up in the morning than that, right? Wow.
And that uniqueness and understanding what that uniqueness is can somehow enable us in a way that might not have been already happening, because everybody's been unique inherently all along, but somehow this teaching and this understanding can help us show up differently. Does it offer a vision of hope, and how do you understand that that hope, or that way that this might empower us to transform culturally?
Fantastic. So I mean, I think, Terry, the question is, what's the myth that invites us to live our lives? And when I say myth, of course, I'm using the way that we would both use it, you know, a.k.a. Joseph Campbell, you know, the myth and the large vision, right? Today there's an evolutionary myth, right? It's an evolutionary myth, which it means it's larger than mere science, right? It's the lodestone, it's the North Star by which we live our lives. So what's the myth that invites a person, right, to their life? So up till now, let's say the Enlightenment myth has been to move beyond your uniqueness, right? To move beyond is separateness and uniqueness were conflated. Move beyond your sense of being a personality, a separate self, realize your true nature is part of the one. So that's not going to inspire a person, right, to give their unique gift. Or the classical mythic, right, vision of, let's say, blue level mythic membership religion, right, your job is to be virtuous, which is wonderful. What could be better than that, right? It's to live in a moral context, which is fantastic, right, and to be, you know, obedient and aligned with the higher power, in terms of whatever your system or code is. Now, that's, of course, beautiful, just like the Enlightenment teaching is beautiful. So the mythic membership religious teaching and the Enlightenment teaching are fantastic. Then look, so they've got the religious teaching, the Enlightenment teaching. Third, you'll have the psychological teaching. Be a whole person. You know, Freud talked about equilibrium. Be balanced, so you're not dysfunctional and destructive. You can have a balanced, whole, harmonious life. So that'd be the psychological vision. You might have your sociological, you know, Western vision of, you know, personal fulfillment and happiness. So all of those visions we just outlined, which actually cover very well, right, the basic understandings and myths of society, none of them invite, obligate, even demand that a person's raison d'etre, that would make the very purpose of a person's life is actually to identify their uniqueness and to give the gifts that well from their uniqueness. So what unique self does is it actually shifts the essential life myth, right, the essential meta-narrative, right, of what it means to be a human being in the world. But it's different than the psychological myth. It's different than the Enlightenment myth. It's different than the religious myth. And it's different than the Western secular bourgeois myth. Now, it may take a piece from each of those. Personal fulfillment from the Western bourgeois myth, you know, psychological balance from the psychological myth, the psychodynamic myth, right? Clarity about one's true nature as a true self, right? So we don't confuse unique self and ego, right? From the Enlightenment myth, right? Living in a moral context with ethical mindfulness, right? From the religious myth. So unique self will, of course, transcend. It'll end the trance of any of these myths and include them, and include all the good in them and bow reverentially before all of them, yet it transcends and includes, right? And it actually offers, right, a vision in which Western individuality, which then got mired in ego and became a kind of egoic, grasping, competitive, you know, kind of endeavor, which is why the teaching of evolving beyond exclusive identification with ego is so essential. We can now take that core intuition of Western individuality and actually realize that it's actually the sacred invitation, right, to live your enlightened unique self, which is not a regression to ego, right? It's not a contraction, but it's actually the fullest explosion of the wonder, magnificence, and beauty that you are, which is not just aesthetically beautiful, but which is morally necessary for all that is, right? And which holds a piece of the truth that no one else holds. So both from the perspective of the good, the true, and the beautiful, right, we need you as your unique self, right? We desperately need your service, your offering, your gift. And to be called to that, it's that kind of calling that actually offers us the kind of beacon of hope, right, to move, you know, it's the awakening beyond awakening, as we talked in our email exchange. And so that's the invitation. That's why this is so utterly essential. It completely changes and transforms, right, the way you internally live your life and brings you to a place of deep and profound realization through living your unique gifts, not from the level of ego, not from a competitive place, but paradoxically, when you live your unique gifts, you open up, right, to the evolutionary we intelligence, because your uniqueness opens you to people. It doesn't close you. Right? Once you're living your unique self, then you move beyond the jealousy. You can actually then begin to appreciate the unique wonder of someone else. Right? When someone else is, you know, writing their book, when they're doing their teaching, when they're doing their kindergarten, you know, working with the children, and they're being a preschool teacher, when they're being a whatever, you can actually appreciate the full wonder of someone else's unique gifts because you're living from your own fullness. So it both changes essentially the source code of your inner subjective interpersonal relationship. It creates an evolutionary we space integral kind of community, right? And, right, it offers your unique gifts to a world which desperately needs them.
I have a couple different directions I feel like going at once, Mark. I know there
That's
are
exciting,
probably
huh?
some people. Yeah, thank you. There are some people who are going to be wondering. I mean, there's kind of one piece. Maybe some folks are going to wonder how then does it become important to identify my unique gift? If that uniqueness is my nature and I open the channels and it flows, isn't that enough? Do I have to look at it and think about it? Doesn't it sound so similar to the kind of self-involvement that people have where they're constantly, you know, meditating on their own ego, you know, and maybe people could interpret it in a way that could indulge that. Isn't it more important just to let it flow? And when I let it flow, do I need to think about it? Help it understand why that's a spiritual practice rather than a form of indulgence of selfing?
Right. No, fantastic. It's a great, great inquiry. So let's take it from a couple of different places. You know, there's always the perspective which says let it flow, right? You know, but actually, right, any great accomplishment is, number one, cumulative, meaning we do it rigorously over life. We don't do it in just one burst. And two is it requires some level of rigorous attention and practice. So the notion that you can actually live your unique self simply by letting it flow is, in the end, will be disingenuous for people, right? Actually, right, in order to actually, you know, identify, you know, where you want to spend your time. This is what William James called a genuine option, right? Meaning we have X amount of time in our lives, we have any number of different paths available to us. So to actually be able to meditate, and when I spoke about this to the Dalai Lama a number of years ago, he says, very good, very good. You know, the way he does that, he says, need analytic meditation, right? You do an analytic, what they call in Tibetan Buddhism, as you know, an analytic meditation, where you actually ponder, you know, which Buddha family are you connected to? It's why there are five Buddha families, right? I mean, the reason there are typologies in all the great religions is because actually it matters to actually have a level of self-knowledge, right? And of course, self-knowledge can always degenerate into narcissism, right? Just like sexuality can always degenerate into, you know, a kind of subhuman depravity, right? Anything that's great and has light will, of course, have shadow. So any kind of selfing can be selfing with a small s, and if I can borrow your verb, selfing, or with a large s, right? I can degenerate into narcissism and self-indulgence, and I'm taking 16,000 courses a year, right, in order to identify what, you know, what I should be doing in the world. Right, and basically my profession becomes taking the courses, right? In other words, it's another way, right, to engage myself. You know, as someone once said about psychology, you know, you're actually paying a person to talk about yourself. Why wouldn't you do that? But of course, that's not quite what psychology is. That's the narcissistic dimension of psychology. That's the shadow of psychology. But I think we would all agree that psychology actually offered something significant and new in the evolution of consciousness, and that Freud and Jung are actually, and, you know, and Melanie Klein and the 11 major schools that, you know, our friend Ken talks about in integral psychology, each one actually added something. So in that same way, right, is there a danger that unique self can be hijacked by the ego? Let's kind of say it directly. Of course there is. And is it important to point out that danger as you have? Absolutely. Right? Which is why when we actually taught the unique self at Integral Spiritual Experience, right, a year ago, we actually offered a paper that's online about 25 distinctions between unique self and ego. Very important distinctions. So to actually do the work of actually identifying your unique self, not in an obsessive way, not in a self-indulgent way, but not quite to just let it flow. It's actually, because you really have to make decisions, right? We actually can't live, as William James says someplace, we can't live all of the lives, right? I can't be this and this and this and this and this. Actually, right, every time we say yes, we're saying no to something else. And when I actually begin to realize the preciousness of my life, right, and the value, all right, of my unique gifts, I actually have a responsibility, right, to clarify where am I going to put my energy? Where am I going to put my time? Not from the perspective merely of self-fulfillment or self-involvement, from the perspective of what's needed, right? So if I would look at the five uniquenesses, I said I want to look at my unique gift, and what do I do really well? What am I gifted in doing? Two, I'd want to look at my unique pleasure, meaning what actually gives me vitality, right? My unique pleasure / vitality. Then I'd want to look at what's the unique need, right, of my time, right? What's the unique need of my time, right? What's the evolutionary need that can be addressed, right, in my time, right? Four, I'd want to look at what's the unique need in my natural circle, right? As I live in Fairfax, right? And I don't live in China. So what does that mean? What's my relationship to, right? What's my, right? And, you know, so I'd want to look at all those uniquenesses. I want to look at my unique shadow and see how that plays in the story. So I'd want to look at those set of uniquenesses, right, to be able to try and map and chart, right? How am I going to actually invest, right, this divinely animated unique expression, right, that is me. And the way the Kabbalists said it, who were kind of clearly, you know, all about evolution beyond identification with ego, they said you have to identify what's your unique letter in the Torah. The Torah as in the Dharma, the Tao, the cosmic scroll. That actually, if I'm writing your letter in the Torah, I'm engaged in forgery. Right? I'm a plagiarizer. Right? I need to be writing my letter in the Torah. I need to be living my unique story. And again, without being obsessive, right, I want to actually give that some attention, some practice, right, some energy, so that I can actually do the spiritual practice of living my unique self, which is life as practice. Right? When I'm actually living my unique self, I'm actually engaged in life as practice. My life itself becomes, right, a spiritual practice, right, and it gives me a sense of fullness and vitality that I don't get when I'm actually experiencing myself even though I may have fooled everyone else, but internally I kind of feel the sense of I'm an imposter. And I'm living someone else's story. Right? I haven't actually, right? I'm singing someone else's song. I'm writing someone else's poem. But it's only when I realize that there's a way of laughing, loving, living, being, and becoming in the world that's uniquely connected to me, right, that I actually fall down and kneel and worship. It doesn't create arrogance, it creates humility. It creates obligation and creates enormous respect and honor of the other because I realize that they have actually, right, that same invitation. So that's just to begin to kind of dance into, right, that beautiful inquiry, Terry.
Thank you. Well, as you walk this path and you embrace this uniqueness in a time that has a clearly a unique host of needs, how, you know, if we look back on spirituality over the centuries, it's been always a part of the heart fiber that has held the healthy human adaptive response in place, such that we've continually, you know, kept going, such that we've met the challenges of being alive. But it hasn't become an overwhelming factor. And yet we are in a time in which a kind of human cooperation, a kind of clarity, a capacity to make conscious choice relative to big stuff has to make these tremendous advances, and right now people's religious beliefs are dividing them, the sources of some of the worst conflicts in the world. What gives you hope? How does this dharma of unique self have direct relevance to your engagement as an expression of God's love incarnate in a human body mind, doing what's necessary to keep evolution growing and turning and going around this bend in the river, not just crashing into some sort of a regressive episode?
Beautiful. That's you're batting 1,000 today, Terry, and it's just such an awesome inquiry, right? And let's just try and again dance it together, you know, kind of dance into the question and see, you know, together what emerges. So I think I'd approach it from three different perspectives, all which are very, very practical and very real. So one, you know, you talk about kind of the collective, right? You know, that we're all in this, you know, we have a notion today of kind of being part of this we space, you know, in a way that we never did before. And actually our colleague and friend Craig Hamilton wrote a fantastic article about like a decade back in What is Enlightenment, as it used to be called, on collective intelligence, where he did a really, really nice job of, I remember enjoying the article when I read it before I met Craig, which really did a nice job of kind of bringing together both some spiritual perspectives and the kind of corporate perspectives that we're playing in the corporate boardroom on how groups of people come together and actually create a larger voice than the individual, you know, which might be called something like collective intelligence or evolutionary we space. Right, which was actually the core, paradoxically, the reason I've always been so interested in this topic, because it was actually the core of the technology in the ancient Hebrew wisdom study hall, in which the Shekhinah, the kind of goddess, right, the presence of all that is, was called Knesset Yisrael, which is the community. And whenever 10 people dwell together, the old text says, right, the Shekhinah dwells in them. So it's a description of a kind of collective intelligence, and the entire Beit Midrash, the entire study hall, was built on how you actually foster, right, this kind of we space, this kind of collective intelligence. So in terms of my native original tradition before I began to engage world spirituality, which was Kabbalah, this was always, you know, just completely both fascinating and seemed unbelievably compellingly important in a world in which we spaces are becoming more and more necessary, in which they're more and more essential. We can't actually live without actually creating a global we space. And it used to be you could create a we space in Nepal and, you know, and one in Russia and one in, you know, Uzbekistan. But today we actually need, right, this kind of wider global we space in order to actually survive. And we need kind of sub we spaces that link together in this larger meshwork. So from that perspective, that's the first place that unique self is essential. Because how does a collective intelligence or an evolutionary we space emerge? Well, let's think about it for a second. right? From the perspective of ego, of separate self, you're never going to develop an evolutionary we space, right? It'll never happen. It can't happen, right? Because the ego is basically clashing with the other egos. And the ego is asserting, you know, ana emloch in the language of the old text, I rule, right? I'm special. You're not, right? It's asserting its primacy, and it's desperately grasping, you know, and for that reason, you know, the skull grins in at the banquet. You know, ultimately, it doesn't work, right? You know, ultimately, we get this competitive, brutal world, this natural state of war, right? So the egoic state that all the great traditions identified, right, doesn't actually create a we space. The best the egoic state can do is make an agreement, a kind of social contract like we do in democracy, that we'll all withdraw some of our I-ness in order to create a kind of collective space for a government to protect us. But that's actually not a genuine we space. And that's why, you know, Putnam's famous book, Bowling Alone, described the loneliness in the United States, the alienation, right, in the United States, right, and all over the world, ultimately, because, right, separate selves don't create a we space. And there's not a larger wisdom, right, that comes through separate selves as they come together. At best, there's a kind of tabulation of the vote. And we all know that the vote doesn't necessarily produce wisdom. So separate selves can't create a we space, right, that creates the kind of evolutionary wisdom that's going to take us to the next level. At the same time, let's go to the next step. True self, the kind of classical vision of enlightenment, true self, I'm part of the one. I've left my individuality behind, right? Right. I express myself, the total number of true selves is one, right? Well, that's not a we space, right? What it is it's a oneness space. But in that oneness space, when we're all merged into the one, first it has great shadow. The shadow expression would be the cult or the totalitarian society, as Hannah Arendt wrote, you know, or, you know, all of the kind of fascistic expressions, right, of that kind of vision, right, or the kind of spiritual expressions when the individual obligation, the individual initiative, right, is lost. So true self is not going to create a collective intelligence or an evolutionary we space. So what will? What will happen is a kind of evolutionary, right, unique self, right, which comes together with the other unique selves to create this larger space. That's what's going to create the collective intelligence, right, in all of the small groups and in the larger kind of national groups and ultimately the larger global groups will be created by the meeting of fully empowered, free-functioning, you know, second-tier consciousness unique selves that come together, not in a brutal clash of egos, right, but in the creation of this gorgeous, loving evolutionary we space. Because remember, the core of evolutionary we space is love. Right? Love, right, is to see someone, to be a lover is to see with God's eyes. Right? And it's to see the unique self of other. Love is a unique self-perception. So we come together in this larger field of love as the evolutionary force that animates the cosmos, right, and we create this larger space in which we actually work together, right? We do an event together of teaching in which, you know, groups of teachers begin to teach together, right? In which, you know, teachers pass students between each other, in which each government, right, does what it can do, deployed where it is in the world, in which each system of spirit has its own medicine to offer, right, to the larger, right, healing, right, that's needed in the cosmos. So evolutionary we space, right, is created, right, by unique self. And so that's the first kind of offering, right? And the second, which I'll just say briefly, is just the notion of perspectives, right? The notion of a unique perspective, when it's not from a level of consciousness of unique self, right, quickly devolves into ego. Right? My perspective is my egoic personality understanding of the world, which is naturally going to clash with yours, right? I'm going to have to assert the primacy of mine. You know, and ultimately, right, there's going to be, you know, very, very strong clash because the boundary between us is not permeable. Whenever you have a boundary line, you have a battle line. But when you actually evolve your consciousness and you realize, well, no, I'm not actually a solid fixed boundary of ego. I'm actually a much more permeable unique self, right? I'm actually part of the seamless coat, which is not featureless, as we said in the beginning. I'm a unique expression of all that is, but part of all that is, when that actually becomes part of my consciousness, then, right, my ability, right, to move beyond ego and to make a contribution or not to get lost in that egoic contracted self, right, shifts and literally everything changes. I mean, if we understand anything today, we know that only a genuine shift in consciousness will open up the new evolutionary possibilities that are necessary, right, in order to actually take the next step. And so what I would say is, again, unique self isn't everything, right? No teaching's everything, right? And again, you know, it's not okay, unique self, we're done. But unique self is part of a tapestry of teaching. It's a lodestone in a new emergent evolutionary world integral spirituality, right? You know, in which one can be a dual citizen, you know, with another religion, right? And yet also perhaps be beyond all the religions if they can't locate themselves there. And that there's core lodestones in this new great teaching. There's core lodestones. And each of us will contribute. And, you know, and many of our friends, right, are working on different pieces of this teaching. So unique self is a lodestone, right? It's part of the source code. It's part of the core technology, right, of any new evolutionary teaching that's going to, you know, of a kind of world spirituality that's going to take us the next level. And therefore it's important not just in spirituality, right, as you well know so well, but in medicine, right, and in law and in commerce and in, you know, in every, in education and every possible field of endeavor, right, the new great sacred myth of unique self, post-individuality, post-ego, right, this post-enlightenment or expression of enlightenment realization, right, really changes everything. It changes everything in this kind of subtle source code kind of way, and it offers enormous hope, right, for what it means to be a human being and for the possibility of possibility, right, of the human future.
Now, Mark, I know that you've spent a good deal of your adult life commuting back and forth between America and Israel, and you've been close up on one of the sources of conflict that some people sometimes are afraid could erupt into a cataclysmic conflict, a clash of civilizations kind of thing. And you've had to really live at the level of how there are no easy answers to some of these deep things. And yet, we are living in a time in which human populations are outstripping the planet's carrying capacity, perhaps. Many things are reaching boiling points. There are many of these graphs that we look that have this hockey stick at the end where things are reaching some kind of singularity. Other graphs are crossing each other. You've got peak oil, peak water, peak food, peak everything. You know, there's a tremendous clamor of crisis in the air. In the midst of that, do you feel like you're called in a special way? Is there a kind of heroism that the times are asking for? And is that part of the unique gift of people today? And if so, how would that express itself? I mean, especially for the wide range of people. Not everybody feels personally like a leader. You know, it isn't always given to people to do something overtly heroic. And yet the times seem to call for something special, to use your word. So what is the specialness of this time, and how are you called to meet it, and how would you call others to meet it, and how can that call be sufficiently humble and you know, before the tremendous knotty problems of our world?
Thank you. Well, let me just reflect. Thank you so much, Terry. Let me just reflect back on the questions, just to kind of meditate with you on them out loud. So one, you ask about, you know, is this a heroic time? Is there a heroism required in this time? So I think that's kind of one inquiry. And as part of that inquiry, you ask me personally, well, how are you called to meet it? But also you ask, how would you call others to meet it? And at the same time, you say, and well, how can that be done in a way which actually holds genuine humility, right? Number four. And the fifth thing that you're kind of pointing to, and how do we do it in a world in which the problems are, I think the word you used, so naughty, you know, naughty, not in naughty, right? although there are those also, but naughty with a K, right? Naughty, you know, they're naughty. And you point in the beginning of what you said, you know, you pointed to kind of, you know, the Israeli-Arab, you know, kind of tragic conundrum, you know, as a kind of example of, something which just doesn't allow for easy or facile solutions. So it's really kind of a five-point inquiry that you're offering. And let me just try and just kind of touch very briefly, lightly, and try and kind of dance with you in this, you know, in this space. So let's begin with the hero, right? You know, and I think that this is, you know, this is an age of heroism, right? And when the hero used to be Achilles, you know, or used to be Odysseus, you know, in the old epics, you know, or used to be, you know, the Eastern heroes and those versions of the story, or the Native American heroes. But the hero was always the one, was always the differentiated one, right? The hero was the unique one, and everyone else was kind of singing the song of the hero. So if there's a democratization of enlightenment, there's a democratization of heroism. Right? There's a requirement for heroism. We need heroes, right? And the world is, I think, filled with heroes. You know, and I think that the second thing that you point to, that I want to pick up on and reflect back to you and to share with everyone, is that to be a hero doesn't mean what it used to mean in ancient Greece, if we can borrow that kind of Western model of the hero, in which the essence of the hero was fame. You know, Jacob Burckhardt, you know, in his famous essay, Renaissance essay on, you know, on what heroism meant, you know, and what fame meant in the Renaissance and the kind of history of fame. So fame comes from this Greek notion that the hero's deeds need to be recorded and sung for the ages, okay? And William Safire has a book. William Safire, the New York Times columnist, has a book called Great Speeches in History, which are about these great famous speeches. And I remember reading it and then writing in that book, Soul Prince, which I wrote a decade back or more. And it's even more than that. Wow, it's like 13, 14 years, like a long time ago when we were young, Terry, right? You know, that book, I remember being so angry when I read it. Because I said to myself, great speeches in history are the public speeches? Is that true? I mean, there's great speeches at, you know, 4 in the morning, right, between lovers. There's speeches at the kitchen table, right? There's the speech that a young daughter gives to her father, right, that a mother gives to her son, right? You know, there's the speech that, I hear, right? I mean, great speeches in history are not public speeches. This kind of Western Greek-influenced, you know, Renaissance-dominated notion of fame, which is about, you know, my unique self has to be played out in the public arena, and if I'm not Barack Obama, I'm somehow a failure, and then however that myth plays itself out, right, is a tragic misunderstanding of human destiny and human character, and I want to be really careful not to in any way conflate that with unique self. Unique self, as you implicitly, kind of held, unique self is played out in many, many arenas, right, which are often and usually private. When I say private, I mean they're not on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle or the New York Times. Right? They don't appear on the Integral Life website or the Beyond Awakening website or the I Evolve or Center for World Spirituality website. It doesn't, right? It doesn't happen at a, right? It happens, right, in the realm of community, in the realm of family, in the realm of the social networks in which we live, which were so aptly caricatured. Right, in that recent movie, Social Network, which was about a network that's not a network and friends that aren't friends. Is a Facebook friend really a friend, right? Right. But so there's a deep sense in which there's a heroic privacy, right, to living one's unique self. Heroic privacy meaning, let me try and kind of feel our way into this together to really try and land it together with you, right, meaning when I live my unique self, right, that affects everything. Right, and although I might not always be able to see how it affects everything, right, but actually, similar to the butterfly effect in physics, when a butterfly flaps its wings in Tokyo and affects what's happening in New Orleans, so if that's true about a butterfly's wings, imagine how it's true when you live the unique contours of your resplendent story, which is God's signature written all over you. Right, when you live that story, the ripple effect of it is so dramatic, coursing right through all worlds, upper and higher and middle, right, and reconfiguring right all that is. Right, that's precisely right the notion of wholeness, the interconnectivity of the all with the all that lies at the core of any genuine evolutionary consciousness. And evolutionary consciousness has an experience of wholeness, which is one of what I talked about many, many years ago to myself, and wrote it in a book just because I wanted to say it out loud. One of the major faces of Eros. Right, not in the sense of the sexual, Eros in the sense of the deep fullness of all that is, right, is the realization of wholeness. the realization of the interconnectivity of the all with the all. And the way, and here's the key, this is the next unfolding of the unique self, you know, Dharma teaching, the way you connect with all that is through your unique self. It's the puzzle piece Dharma of enlightenment. It's the puzzle piece Dharma of connectivity. It's actually the contours of your uniqueness. Again, not your personality, not your ego, right? Not your grasping, flailing, right, small self, but it's the unique contours of the puzzle piece. Like you have a fingerprint, you have a unique self print, right? It's that print which imprints you, right, into the source code of all of reality. But it's that puzzle piece, right, which actually fits you into the larger puzzle of all that is, and in some sense completes all that is in a way that nothing else could, right? So actually, we kind of think that, well, why don't we meditate or chant or practice in order to round out, right, our uniqueness to become part of oneness? Well, and then we'll have the oneness blessing, right? Then the oneness blessing will live in us. No, I actually do my spiritual practice, right, to actually burn away, to clarify the dross, right, of my imperfect uniqueness, of my egoic grasping, right? I want to actually evolve beyond my identification with my egoic grasping to let the unique puzzle piece that is me, that is you, emerge in resplendent gorgeousness, and then that unique puzzle piece fits into the great puzzle of all that is and completes the puzzle, offers what we call in Kabbalah a tikkun, right, a fixing, right? I have, as you've met him, you were actually at his initial birth ceremony. I'm in a new young son named Zion. And in Hebrew, a baby is called a tinok, right? Tinok, a baby. So tinok plays with the same Hebrew letters, the Kabbalists point out, as tikkun. And tikkun is the unique fixing that's yours to do. So, but the way the kind of the teaching goes as we're evolving it here together, right? The unique fixing is the purpose of your birth, right? It's by living the contours, the texture, right, the fabric of your unique self, that you become the puzzle piece, the unique puzzle piece, which then connects you to all that is. So the face of Eros, which is wholeness, which is the interconnectivity of the all with the all, right, which is the experience of enlightened consciousness, right, is fulfilled, happens through living my unique self. That's actually precisely how I impact. So that's the heroic act. The heroic act is to actually be that puzzle piece and to offer in my very being and becoming a level of completeness to all that is that wasn't available to it before me, and that creates in me utter humility. Utter humility, right? Because, oh my God, I'm serving, right? I'm kneeling and kissing the ground, right? I'm just completely aroused, right, to the humbleness of my service and the joy of my service as I realize that every evolved being is doing the same thing with me, and together we sing this great song of praise. So that's the experience, right, of unique self, right? And that's, for me, you know, that's what I'm called to live in my life, right? And that's what I'm called to call others to live, right? And to actually share this teaching, and as I hope that, you know, that my good close circle of friends will always help me clarify and to make sure that, you know, I stay connected to that unique calling. So that's what I might call the puzzle piece teaching of unique self, in which you're able to offer a completion through being your puzzle piece that's only offerable through you, which infuses your life with meaning.
Right? How does that relate to your sensitivity to the other? How does that...
Beautiful.
You know, because, you know, when we look at the growling pit of human conflict over history, people seem to be trying to live out their own idea of what their life story ought to be with a competitive and domineering kind of agenda. At least the alpha males of history seem to have enacted it that way. And so this has to be an expression that is, you know, people at a lower level of development with a lot of egoic drives that are uninspected would think that their unique expression, you know, everybody tends to be a little bit in love with their own image as to the degree that they're egos and they have a somewhat self-glorified agenda. And that only is going to produce the same kind of vying for prominence, vying for airtime, vying for the attention of others, vying for whatever that has been the extension of the dreary past. And so there's got to be a way that in our uniqueness we are not just expressive but receptive, and not just receptive but in service, and not just able to feel a communion and a sense of our own specialness, but to be even more inspired by the specialness of something greater than ourselves that we're living in service of. How does that all flow together?
Yeah, no, I think that's precisely right, right? That is to say, if I live at a level of egoic consciousness, and let's be clear, right? The first three chakras, right? You know, security, sexuality, power, however you tell those story, if we'll use the Hindu image of chakras, but, you know, or the core needs of Maslow, if you want to use a more kind of, you know, ostensibly secular image, you know, the need for security, then for belongingness, right? Then for self-esteem. Right, those needs can hijack anything. They can hijack evolutionary spirituality, right? They can hijack sacred religion, right? They can hijack being an evolutionary, or they can hijack unique self, right? I'm an evolutionary. I'm at the leading edge, right? I mean, when people talk about the leading edge, right? How easy is it for any of us who talk about the leading edge to say that the leading edge is just another boomeritis, narcissistic expression of placing myself at the leading edge and everybody else not at the leading edge? I'm at the leading edge of evolution, right? I'm talking about the evolutionary, right? In other words, and whenever we talk about the global vision, whenever we take responsibility, whenever we talk about an evolutionary edge, right? Whenever we talk about an edge, whenever we make any kind of hierarchy, any kind of distinction, right? Distinctions always risk hijacking, right, by narcissism and ego. That's their nature, right? So that doesn't mean that distinctions aren't important. That doesn't mean that, you know, hierarchies aren't real, right? It means that we need to distinguish between, as Rhian Eisler did, right, you know, and our friend Ken, you know, cited Eisler extensively in Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality, right, between a dominator hierarchy and a holistic hierarchy, and that distinction's important. So I think, again, it's really, really important not to have this sense that we're going to kind of attack uniqueness because it can be hijacked by the ego, right? The same way we won't attack this notion of an evolutionary edge because it can be hijacked by the ego. We won't attack sexuality because it can be hijacked by, you know, the lower chakras, right? And it's very, very clear that everything has its shadow and light. Right? And it's very, very important not to kind of engage in this kind of, we'll attack any idea by its shadow side. So that's number one. I think that's just an important kind of distinction, right, you know, that we always need to make. So that's kind of number one. You know, and number two of it is the very nature of the unique self-experience. Right? One of the ways to distinguish, actually, which I think really goes to the heart of your inquiry, Terry, the way to distinguish between whether a person is living from unique self or from ego really has to do with two things. One is, how do they respond to other? Exactly as you say. Right, if I'm living from ego, but pretending to be unique self, so ultimately the rising of other, right, others expressing their unique gifts, right, the splendor of other, ultimately makes the person feel bad. It gives them an egoic heartburn, right? So first thing is to check a person, to check themselves internally. How do you genuinely feel? Right, not what you say publicly, not what you write. How do you genuinely feel, right? You know, as the Hasidic masters used to say, it's easy to be friends when we're at equal level. It's also possible to be friends, not so hard when one of us is down, because you're always helping the other. But do you really rejoice at a friend's emergence and expression of their unique gifts? And that's really the question. And that's where you're checking. Am I living from ego? I'm disguising it in evolutionary language, unique self language, you know, unique self, future of enlightenment, evolutionary, you know, edge. But really, it's just a very clever disguise for ego that's so good at creating the particular artifice and fig leaf needed to sustain itself, right? And so that's a really great way to check. I think what you're essentially offering is a litmus test, right, for are we engaged at egoic consciousness or at unique self-consciousness? The nature of unique self-consciousness is that it opens up and rejoices and delights in other. That's one of the essential litmus tests, which is why it creates we space. Right? Its very essential nature, right, is not to contract. So I think that's a really, really good litmus test, meaning I'm special and you're special. That doesn't mean we're the same. That doesn't mean there's a leveling of differences, but it means that we're each deployed by all that is in a unique place and that we need each other. And that's the second litmus test. The second litmus test is the realization of our interdependence, that we actually genuinely need each other and that there's something that each of us need to do, right, that can't be done, right, by ourselves, you know, by anyone else but us, and there's something else that our circle of friends, right, need to do that can only be done by them, right, and that it creates an actual sense of communion, right? Paradoxically, you would think that unique self would create a kind of, you know, powerful autonomy. It does, right, but in direct dance and dialectical tension, right, with communion, right, in unique self, the split between autonomy and communion is effaced as it becomes a natural dance step. As you move in between autonomy and communion, which is the kind of natural rhythm, right, of unique self-living. And so it engenders an enormous humility. Right? I mean, I think the demarcating characteristic of living from unique self is precisely that humility and that communion. And finally, it's what do we do when we're attacked? Right? When we're attacked, do we react from an egoic posture? Right? Are we actually reactive and, you know, do we kind of attack back, which is, by the way, sometimes necessary and sometimes important. So I don't want to make a kind of pacifist statement. You know, sometimes that's an important thing to do. As the Dalai Lama said, you know, you do need an army, but, you know, there's too many of them. But sometimes a kind of counterattack is necessary, right, in a world of samsara, you know, tragically so. But other than in those situations, are we able to inhibit the reactive mechanism of ego, hold the larger evolutionary picture, right, and act from that place of unique self, which is genuinely compassionate, and which is open, and which love is open through the pain, right, and which holds other, you know, in a genuine way, you know, and I think these are really the litmus tests, right, of the distinction, right, between, you know, unique self and ego, and between a genuine evolutionary leading edge teaching, right, and a kind of elitist narcissistic teaching. Right, the distinction between those two is enormous, and you know I think that all of us, you know, are really working on elucidating that distinction. So I think what you point to is really the way that you can really test both ourselves, because we're all testing ourselves every day. You know, in other words, we're all kind of checking in on this every day, right? And we can also kind of test the teachings themselves. So I hope that begins to kind of dance into your inquiry.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, I've let us go on a little bit later than our usual transition point, and I know there are other people here who'd like to join the conversation. So I want to take this moment for a few announcements and to let you folks know who are listening live. If you're listening via the web, please go ahead and type out a question in the instant teleseminar window now. And if you'd like to raise your hand to ask a question live, if you've called in on the phone, just press *2. And while you're doing that, I have a couple of announcements. First of all, if you want to find out about Dr. Mark Gaffney's work, you can visit markgaffney.com, markgaffni.com, ievolve.org, ievolve.org, and centerforworldspirituality.com. I won't spell that one out. Center for World Spirituality. Also, I'd like to have your attention for a moment, because I have an important announcement to make. Initially, when I set out to bring about and host this teleseries, I knew it was going to be something that would benefit a lot of people, but I wasn't expecting the overwhelming positive response to these dialogues, and quite frankly, it's blown me away. Over the past 3 months, we've built a community of over 35,000 people. We've had thousands of comments come in. We now have a little over 4,000 fans on Facebook following the conversation and contributing to it. And I've just been so humbled and grateful. And given all this, I've decided to transition and transform the Beyond Awakening series into what I'd like to call an internet radio show that will continue throughout 2011. The series will continue mostly with two dialogues a month. And last but not least, for those of you who have sent so many questions on spiritual practice and who continue to do so, I have something that I've been working on that I'm very excited about that I'll be telling you more about soon once it's ready, so please stay tuned about that. And thank you so much for your sincere participation in this inquiry, for your support, and for your sincere interest in this dialogue with me. I'm really excited about what has unfolded and what is continuing to unfold here. And please stay on the line, because after the end of the Q&A that Mark and I will be doing, I will tell you a little more about my upcoming interviews this week. I'll be speaking with Carter Phipps on Thursday in just 4 days, and then next Sunday, a week from today, at this same time, I will be the special guest, and I'll be offering some of my reflections on what I've learned and some of the themes and inquiries that I see ahead. And then we'll open up the line so we can hear some of each other's voices as we say goodbye. So let's see, what do we have here? We have an interesting question here from Deidre Cole from Montkisco, New York. She asks, if a person had a traumatic childhood and it runs into traumatically charged feelings as he or she actually begins to expand into true self, that is, that expansion beyond the contracted ego triggers a time when the true self as a dependent child was traumatized. How do you deal with that?
So that's a true self question, and thank you very much. Give me them, Deirdre, Terry?
Deirdre, yeah.
Deirdre, thank you for your inquiry, and blessings to you in Mount Kisco, and thank you for being with us. So I think what you're pointing to is something that all of us who've taught in this, in this sense, true self teaching, that we've all, been asked this question, and in our own evolution to true self, we've experienced it, right? Meaning, when you move beyond your fixed personality structures that you use to defend against, right, all of the early wounding that happens as part of our life on this planet. It's not a tragedy. It's just what happens. Well, the nature of being a human being is that we engage wounding, and how we respond to wounding is about who we are. So when we loosen the fixities of our personality structure, then the old wounding comes up. And what we then need to do is establish a space of spaciousness in which we can actually non-judgmentally, right, just encounter that which comes up, non-reactively, actually locate myself in emptiness using the Buddhist term, or in kind of spacious emptiness, which is a better translation of that term in Hebrew, ayin. And I locate myself in this, or to say it in a more Sufi Kabbalistic way, I locate myself in the love intelligence of all that is, and I, holding that place of love, I'm able to bear what comes up. I'm able to bear, right, the trauma. I'm able to bear the shadow. When I'm able to bear that, when I'm able to bear that displeasure and that pain, then I become, as one of the recent saints said, I become a true resting place for Jesus. And what they meant was, I don't mean that in a Jesus mythic membership way. I mean, I become a true resting place, right, for true self and ultimately for unique self. So you're absolutely right that in that transition from personality to true self, what emerges is all the stuff. Then I locate myself in a deep center of true self, of love, of spacious emptiness. And from that place, and that's one of the great purposes of meditation or chant, is to locate myself and be able to bear that which comes up. So that's just the beginning of how you kind of can navigate that territory. Of course, you should seek out a direct teacher or teaching, but really work at yourself and your life. I'm just kind of giving a general sense of how you might find your way into that. So I hope that's helpful, and a lot of love.
Thank you so much, Mark. Here's a question from Cassandra from Coarse Gold. Is that Australia? I think it is. Would you go more into the Arab-Israeli conflict in regard to each culture's shadow?
There's a light question.
Right. Well, you might make some general comments, I would hope. instead of the 2-hour version.
Exactly.
Or the 2-day version.
Exactly. There's a light quote. Let's just talk about. But here it is, in a couple of sentences. You know, one is, I just want to make, and I know this is going to be an unpopular statement, but I want to make it for the sake of integrity, right? Whenever you compare cultures, right, you got to be very careful not to level differences. This is one of the key teachings in an evolutionary and an integral, a world spirituality, in a kind of beyond awakening context. We have to be very careful in terms of leveling of differences. So do I think that Israeli culture has shadows? For sure. Do I think Arab culture has shadows? For sure. Do I think that overall, Israeli culture and Arab culture are holding the same level of consciousness? Absolutely not. Right? And I'll prove it to you. Right? Democracy. And just look at the simple levels of consciousness elucidated by our friend Suzanne Cook-Reuter, by Don Beck based in Claire Graves' teaching. Right? I mean, basically, there is no democracy in the Arab world. There's no place where there are women's rights. There are no place where torture, right, isn't a sanctioned institution of state. Right? There's no place where the individual is not fundamentally expendable, right, in some kind of a sensual way. Right? So the notion that basically we're operating with an equal level of consciousness, just not true. And the person who makes that point very beautifully, right, is actually Ken Wilber, right, like in the first 20 pages of Boomeritis, where he points out, speaking specifically about the Israeli-Arab conflict, he points out that when green level consciousness, and in that case he was describing Israeli negotiators, right, make peace with a red level, using spiral dynamics, enemy, who's driven essentially by a kind of blue mythic meme sense merged with a power sense, then basically, you know, green signs a treaty with red, right, thinking everything's beautiful, and then red goes to kill green. That was, I think, Ken's direct point, which is precisely correct. So when we look at the Arab-Israeli conflict, we have to kind of get beyond political correctness, go beyond awakening, as it were, and actually kind of, you know, in an unflinching, courageous, and fearless way, say clearly, we're talking about one democracy, right, in the middle of a kind of sea, right, of totalitarianism, right, of different, you know, fundamentalist sorts. So I know that's a hard thing for the liberal context in the United States to hear, right, and I'm sure it's unpopular to half of the people listening because we're so used to the sound bites. Having said that, you know, clearly Israel makes mistakes. You know, Israel has shadow, right, like America does. You know, Israel and America are in that sense very similar. They're both Western democracies with the classical shadows of Western democracy. You know, one shadow in Israel today is greed, right? You know, there's just an enormous desire for just kind of personal materialistic fulfillment, right, which is just an enormous, you know, kind of shadow in Israeli society today, which is very, very real. And that's a kind of a genuine shadow, right? You know, another shadow in Israeli society today is that there's a portion of Israeli society, not a majority, but I'd say about 25 to 30% of Israeli society that's so decimated, right, by what's happened in Israel the last 50 years that they actually do view the Arab as an other, right, without the ability to actually make discernments between different sectors of the Arab population, between different opportunities, and so it kind of degenerates to a kind of Arab as other in about 25% of the population. And finally, there's another 25% of the population which is religiously, you know, kind of fundamentalist and intolerant, you know, which is, you know, another, you know, piece of Israel. So those are kind of a number of shadows, right, in the Israeli population. In the Arab world, I mean, the fundamental shadow is just a lack of democracy and a lack of human rights, a lack of women's rights, right? I mean, we're talking about the fundamental shadows of the pre-modern world. So the nature of the shadows are different, right? And I'll just give you one example just to highlight it. And Terry, stop me in the next 30 seconds because we've wandered into territory. But I'll just give you one example to highlight it. When there was a tragedy a number of years ago when Baruch Goldstein, an Israeli settler, went in and massacred 25 Arabs, right, who were in a mosque. What actually happened there is actually unclear, but those are kind of the basic facts. Right? Baruch Goldstein was condemned, right, you know, virtually unilaterally by every sector of Israeli society, right, in the most harsh, excoriating and appropriate terms, correctly, utterly and radically condemned. Right, when a Palestinian suicide bomber blows up an Israeli bus of school children, right, and the suicide bomber is buried as a heroic martyr, right, with you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you know, kind of cheering and dancing. So the difference is there tragedy and extremism in both sides? for sure. Is there moral depravity that can occasionally erupt on the Israeli side? For sure. The question is, how does the collective conscience respond to an act of moral depravity, right? With censure or with making that act of moral depravity into a heroic act? That distinction, right, is essential. So I hope that's my friend Cassandra giving you at least a sense, right, of this issue, you know, from a kind of fearless perspective.
Thank you, Mark. Okay. Well, that was rich, even though it was short. I'd like to turn now to a live caller. We have a question from somebody in Hollister, California. I don't have your name, but you're live. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, this is Timothy Wilkin, and I'm in Carmel, but with the modern G voice, I sound like I'm coming from Hollister.
Okay, well, welcome.
I wanted to, and nice to hear you again, Mark, wonderful as always. I wanted to ask a question and then get Mark's response to it. And Terry, I was very impressed with your very hard questions, which were great, and I was equally impressed with Mark's very good answers. The thing about ego self and unique self, as I understand it, is unique self is sort of like true self with a clear sense of the Dharma, meaning duty, or the purpose or the obligation that you have for being a human on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I think is, if you ask yourself, what is the real value of the unique self sharing their gift or giving their gift, and who is that value for? It's really, the value is for community.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark, once when you were teaching, you were talking about a John Wayne movie where they use the term kaddish.
That's right.
You were talking about if a person dies without ever giving their gift, then this is sort of a sacrilege because it's lost forever. And I would say it's lost forever to community. So the thing that's bigger and greater than the unique self is the community of unique selves.
Yes. Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, that sounds like not a question, but a beautiful insight. So I can only say amen. And that's absolutely true. And I think that's really what we were talking about when we talked about that evolutionary we space. Maybe I can, with your permission, Timothy, although probably without it also, because I love you dearly. But let me just delightedly just kind of point to the formula. You know, when I first started talking with, Terry's and my good beloved friend Ken Wilber about unique self. Actually, Terry, your years, right? You said we know each other 4 or 5 years. You know, isn't it amazing? We actually met. I actually thought about it for a second, and I said, I left Israel like almost 5 years ago. So we actually know each other, I think, 7 or 8 years. Isn't that wild? It's much longer than I thought. I did a quick calculation in my mind of when we first met. I think we met at Integral Spiritual Center number 1.
That's true.
Yeah, I think it's like 7 years ago or 7 or 8, like a long time back.
Wow.
Long time back. Yeah, no, I know. I kind of realized, wow, it's a long time ago. So in that initial time when I first began talking to Ken about unique self, what I tried to share with him was a very particular Kabbalistic perspective, which says that when new Torah is created, and Torah is the Dharma, but from a kind of Kabbalistic perspective, it is the Word of God, right? So you've got a text, and the text is this living organism of a text. Right, and that living organism of a text, right, is interpreted by people holding, right, they're standing at a different angle to Mount Sinai, which is the original image of Revelation, or at a different angle to the text. That's how the old texts say it. And from that different angle, they have a different, literally, perspective. So that different perspective gives you the ability to create new Torah, to create a new Word of God. So from that was the way that I was trying to share with Megapandit Ken, this idea of this unique perspective that creates post-true self, creates unique self. Because if you look at it from the perspective of your ego, you can't create new Torah. Right? The way they say it is you have to cry first before you create new Torah, because in crying, you clarify the ego. So the way we would then formulate that is, that then became formulated last year as true self plus perspective equals unique self. That was the formulation of that Kabbalistic idea, right, that Ken offered out of those conversations. What we've realized as we've gone on is precisely what you're pointing to, Timothy, that it's actually not only true self plus perspective, but it's true plus plus perspective, as it were, plus what perspective creates as an obligation, right? That actually your unique perspective creates an obligation, not just an invitation. It's an obligation. An obligation not in the sense of something imposed by some, you know, mythic structure, you know, of church or synagogue, but it's actually imposed by, right, the highest nature of your being imposes upon you this joyful obligation to live your unique story, which opens you up into communion, right, with all that is, and offers your unique gift, even as it rejoices with humility in the unique gift of the other. So that dance is really there, and you point to that notion of duty, which we're actually bringing back online in second tier. And I know that my colleague and dear friend Terry, I'm sure, has talked about this from his context, but that actually from a second tier perspective, obligation comes back online. Duty comes back online. Duty remains not a fundamentalist idea, not a blue mythic meme idea, but actually an enlightened idea, which is an expression not of my servitude, but of my radical freedom and fullness merging and dancing together. So thank you, Timothy, so much. It's delightful to hear your voice.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks, Timothy.
Thank you, Jerry. Wonderful.
Take care. Well, we have, time is going so fast, but here, let me offer a quick question. I think this is a short question that could have a long answer, but maybe an essential answer will be our moment today.
Okay.
Wentworth from Nassau in the Bahamas asks, what is God? Where is God? What is
beautiful.
Man's relationship to God?
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Well, there's a casual way to end, Brother Terry. Right? Wentworth, NASA, Bahamas, what is God? I mean, not only what is God, but what's man's relationship to God? So just spontaneously emerging, right? You know, and whenever one says the divine is, really the sentence has to end there. God is. What did you actually add at the end of that sentence? But since you're asking and Terry's saying, give us something essential as we move towards the closing, so maybe I'll say it this way, paraphrasing Maimonides. He didn't quite say this, but he pointed towards it, right? That the divine is the possibility of possibility, right? The possibility of possibility, right? That is that free evolutionary emerging, right, is what divinity is, right? Man's relationship to the divine is both to worship, to bow before the personal face, the loving face of the possibility of possibility, of the love intelligence that knows my name and holds me, and to realize that wherever I fall into God's hands. That's my second person relationship to that great personal face of divinity. My first person relationship is to incarnate in my unique, authentic, evolutionary, awakened self, to incarnate that possibility of possibility, right, in giving the great gift. Right, and by doing so, right, I become the Buddha. Right, I become, right, the beautiful, unique self who lives and bows and kisses the feet out of all the other Buddhas, you know, and let it be so.
Mm. Well, beautiful, beautiful words with which to bring us to the end of this dialogue. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you so much, Terry.
But before we all say goodbye, and even before I tell you what's coming up, I want to offer a few reminders. You're heartily invited to visit our blog at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog, where I periodically post entries and where you'll find an archive of our past recordings available for download, as well as our upcoming schedule and some very interesting and lively comments, some very rich exchanges that have taken place. And also on our Facebook page at beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook. And if you're not already signed up for this series, please just go to beyondawakeningseries.com itself, and you can also invite any friends who might want to download our past broadcasts. To learn more about my work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And I want to thank Bay Area Integral, which works to create a vibrant, thriving community of integral practitioners in the San Francisco Bay Area. Its purpose is to pioneer the playground where integral culture evolves. So if you're in the greater San Francisco Bay Area, you'll want to visit the brand new Bay Area Integral website at bayareaintegral.com and get on the mailing list. And there's an event tomorrow, Monday, December 13th. Jim Garrison, the founder with Mikhail Gorbachev of the State of the World Forum, will be speaking on climate change and the way of the shaman. That's BayAreaIntegral.com. Also, our Sisters in Evolution at Feminine Power, where evolutionary women around the world are waking up to the extraordinary and committed passion of their feminine power. You can find out more about the acclaimed work of Claire Zammit and Catherine Woodward Thomas and download a free 75-minute audio introduction at the Keys to Feminine Power, at FemininePower.com. And remember to tune in on Thursday, December 16th, 4 days from today, again at 5 p.m., I'll be having a conversation with Carter Phipps, senior editor of Enlightened Next magazine, in a dialogue titled, Are You an Evolutionary? The Birth of a New Kind of Spiritual Practitioner. Evolutionary is a word that we use and hear more and more at the leading edges of the spiritual and cultural conversation, but what does that really mean, and why is it important? And who or what is an evolutionary anyway? Carter will talk about why an evolutionary worldview creates a powerful bridge between the worlds of spirituality and social activism, and he'll describe some of the distinctive qualities he's identified in the men and women who are pioneering this newly emerging path and practice. He's been working on a book for several years. It'll be published this coming fall, not quite a year from now. It's titled Evolutionaries, the People, Passions, and Perspectives that are Shaping a New Synthesis of Science and Spirit. And he'll share some of the discoveries that he's made in that process. And then a week from today, next Sunday, on December 19th, the special guest will be yours truly. After this first season of remarkable conversations, I will be taking some time to reflect on what I've learned and been touched by during these wide-ranging and deep public conversations and of the directions forward that seem most important and useful for us to consider. After that, we'll take a break over the holidays, and then we'll return on Sunday morning, January 6th, at a new time, 10 a.m. Sunday morning, for a conversation with Raphael Kushner on the central role of emotional connection in the evolution of our spirituality. So thank you so much for joining me and Mark tonight. Let's open up our phone lines so that we can all hear each other's voices and say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.
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 Wonderful. Thank you, Mark.